Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem van der Horst. I'm a marketing and brand strategist for those who don't know or who haven't listened to the show yet. And in other words, I help brands understand how best to communicate with their audiences and better understand how people perceive them, better understand how what the brand values are, what their brands are about, and how best to communicate. That might mean anything from doing promotional activities to how your shop's organized, to how your customer service functions, to what your website looks like, what your social media should be talking about, how best to talk about things that would be interesting to the media. So, I mean, it covers a wide range of different things. And I'm also interested in gaming and game design and game mechanics. And I'm looking little by little how to better integrate gaming mechanics inside of marketing and branding activities. May that be inside of the room of the people like figuring out what the brand is about, or inside of your marketing, branding, and communication activities. So in the show, I'm going to have conversations with professionals in all these different fields that are interesting to me. So that might mean often, you know, marketing, branding, advertising, media, game design, but not only. There's a few outliers from time to time. I say this every time, but I'm just going to keep saying it. If you enjoy the show, and if you listen to podcasts regularly, it'd be awesome if you can take some time to either share it with a friend, just post it to social networks, that helps more people find out about it, or even better, take a few minutes and write a review on iTunes or your iPhone podcast application, or if you're on Android, wherever else you get your podcast. So I use Stitcher, you can give it a thumbs up, you can subscribe to the podcast, get the new episodes as they come out. And on the main website, you can also find out about some other things that I write. So, you know, some people like to listen to podcasts, but some people like reading. And I write the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter that's either on the main website at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. And you can sign up and get the new story every Sunday in your email. It's a long form story that tends to kind of blend some personal stories of mine with a few other things. So it might be current events, it might be just random things that I appreciate and that I'm learning about and sharing with other people. And then I tie them to something related to communications, branding, marketing. It really depends, and it changes and varies every week. And I give myself challenges to vary that every week. So to give you an idea, a few weeks ago, I wrote one called Sex, Dopamine, and the History of Roller Coasters, Roller Coaster Rides. I love roller coasters, looked at what happens chemically from a very basic perspective, what happens chemically and what kind of hormones it releases, the mechanics of fear and thrills and excitement, why we go look for that as human beings. Last week, I wrote about the different celebrations around May Day. So that might be the Festival of Spring, also the International Workers Day. And I took a look at, you know, what would I do if I was looking after May Day as a brand? What if I was the May Day brand manager? So I kind of like went into that and imagined a few things there. So you see, it really, really changes every week, and I really encourage you to go check it out. But I also release them online on my blog and on Medium a week after they're released. But the people on email get them first, and it takes usually 5 to 10 minutes to get that on a Sunday. It's all meant to be an enjoyable, interesting, fairly lighthearted read, where you learn something new, but, you know, it's not very heavy and you can, you know, it's Ice Cream Sunday. You have that on a Sunday. What else is going on? Well, actually, talking about that, it was a fantastic weekend, long weekend in London. We had a first day of sun. The winter seems to be finally over. Spring seems to have more or less arrived. It was all sunny on Sunday. I caught up with a friend and had a fantastic brunch and almost got a slight sunburn and just a tiny bit of coloring, which is fantastic. I'm going to the south of France next week for my father's 70th birthday. I'm very excited about that. And hopefully I'll catch even more sun over there and come back and make my other, you know, Londoner friends jealous by how amazing I'll look once I'm all tanned. Anyway, that's completely ridiculous what I'm talking about. Whatever. Talking about brands, we are in the branding and marketing sector today, where I have an awesome guest, Heidi Hackamer. Heidi, for those who listen to the podcast that I published a few months ago with Heather Lefever, Heather recommended talking to Heidi, and Heidi was already on my radar and the list of people I wanted to talk to. She's got extensive, like amazing experience in the branding and marketing industry and worked on a bunch of really random and exciting projects, both in advertising and in fashion with the Six Items or Less, and ran interesting projects and kind of lab experiments with a previous agency she worked at called BBH that we talk about in the interview. And now she has her own brand and marketing strategy business called Wolf and Willowmean, based in New York. So we talk about all that. And she just got back from a motorcycling holiday when we had this conversation. It was a really fun conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. By the end, Heidi also mentions she will be speaking at the ICA Future Flash Conference, organized with Contagious UK and the Institute of Canadian Advertising, I think, or Communication, something like that. It's like Canadian Trade Association for Advertising and Communication. So it's going to be in a few weeks, weekend of the 18th and 19th. I don't think it's a weekend, sorry, but 18th, 19th of May. And the website I'll put in the show notes, it announces the whole event is sold out. But so, of course, if you're already going there, watch out for Heidi. But there might be some videos released afterwards of the talks. So I'll add all the links in the show notes just in case if you want to have a look. And there's a few other talks that Heidi did that I think were available online. So I'll put that on there. But in any case, without further ado, here's Heidi Ackermer. Enjoy. Heidi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on, actually. It's brilliant. I don't know if you had a chance to listen or to any of the ones I did before, but it was out of the conversation I had with Heather Lefever a few weeks ago, and she recommended I talk to you. And and sure enough, I actually already had your name on my list of people I wanted to interview for the podcast.
You don't have to lie. It's okay.
Actually, I mean, I can show you, date stamp it and everything. So for anybody who's not read Heather's book, Brain Surfing, there's also like a tiny, tiny spoiler alert. At the very end, there's a few names mentioned. So Ferris, Rosie, you and I together. So, I mean, I'd heard about you before. So, you know, it was on my radar.
That's awesome. You. I love this.
But I understand. Am I right? I understand it. You're just literally back from holidays.
Yeah, I came back today. Yesterday was my first day back at work.
Okay, cool. So how was your holidays? What was going on? What'd you get up to?
I had a wonderful holiday. I rode my motorcycle from Los Angeles to Florida.
Oh wow!
I put in about 3,300 miles on the bike.
Wow.
And got to see some of our national parks and just kind of meander around for about 2 weeks.
Brilliant. So 2 weeks, how many days riding is that? Are you riding like every other day, every day? How's it?
So the way it worked out is our team happened to have we do an offsite at Wolf and Wilhelmina twice a year.
Okay.
And our offsite was in Joshua Tree, which is right next to one of the big national parks here in the United States. And so when I saw that we were doing an offsite on Monday and Tuesday, I decided to build my vacation around that. So I actually ended up having 13 days of riding, which averaged out to 250 miles a day. But some days I did more so I could relax on other days.
Wow. That sounds amazing. Yeah. And those are the national parks. I've heard so much about Joshua Tree. I'd love to go. I've only been to the Grand Canyon. I would love to go one of these days. Wow, sounds awesome. Is there like one highlight that you can share with us?
Well, I've been to a lot of national parks because I've traveled around the country quite a bit. Mm. And I have to say that I've never been to Death Valley before. And Death Valley was just an incredible, I was kind of blown away. Like I call it wonder fatigue sometimes when I'm in our national parks, because it's like when you're in Yellowstone or when you're in the Grand Canyon, it's just one amazing sight after another.
Yeah.
And that's what Death Valley was like. Like by the end of the day, I was like, I can't see anything else that's awesome because I can't handle it anymore. Yeah.
You should totally listen to it. There's another episode of the podcast with another friend called Hugh Gehry, who last year, just like less than 6 months ago, cycled from Los Angeles to Las Vegas via the Death Valley. At the moment, it was like there was a heat wave and it was the hottest in like, I don't know, 10 years or something ridiculous. Wow. So the stories he had to say were amazing as well. Okay. So like, there's been a bit of changing in, so it doesn't matter because you don't really know, but this is for anybody else listening who's familiar with the show. I noticed, I've hit the ground running with it and I've just been talking with a bunch of people. And this is something you might be familiar with, but I know some strategists are, and or at least I am. So it's one of the traits. I've been doing a lot of research preparing for my interviews, the last few interviews, but like fallen down the research rabbit hole and done way too much, like gone way overboard. And now it was like, okay, I'm just putting too much information in the space. So I've scaled back completely. And for this interview, I've just limited myself to just an hour of research to prepare for it. So a little bit different. And, And yeah, so, but there is one obvious question that's staring at me in the face. So I'm just going to start there. Your company is called Wolf and Wilhelmine, and I'm Willem. So who's got the female version of my name?
Well, and the other funny thing is that my dad's name is Horst. So
seriously?
And his mother's name is Wilhelmina. So that's we have a very weird name connection going on here.
That's very funny. So that's your grandmother on your father's side.
Yes, exactly.
And where's she from?
She's German. She's from Germany. She's not alive anymore, but okay. She was my oma. Yeah. And she was quite an incredible woman.
Yeah.
And I always really admired her, and I just wanted to bring her spirit and honor her by naming the company after her.
Wow. Where is she from in Germany? Where was she from in Germany? Sorry.
It's super complicated because of the war. They were originally Galician Germans who were settlers in Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
And then when the war started, they were moved into Poland. And then as Europe kind of broke down, they escaped into Germany. And then they ended up in refugee camps in Germany.
Wow.
But they were always culturally and from a citizen standpoint, language, schools, religion, they were German.
Mm. So did you get to know her when you were a child, or?
No, she died when I was a year old. So I only have stories of her and one photograph with us together.
Yeah. Is there like a story you're willing to share that you're happy to share with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, from what I know of her, she was incredible. She was a woman who, I'm stumbling a little bit.
That's okay.
1939, my grandfather got drafted into the army right away, and all of the Galician Germans were forced to move into Poland. And she was heavily pregnant with my father at the time. And she got on a train in the winter of 1940 to go from Lviv into Warsaw. And on the train, she went into labor. And in a small little town on the border called Premysh, and I'm totally pronouncing it incorrectly. I apologize to anyone that's Polish that's listening to this. And, she went into labor in Premysh. She got off the train. She had my dad. She got back on the train. And then she went to resettle her life in Poland. She kept my father alive during the war. They escaped the Russians in a horse-drawn wagon. They were put in a Russian refugee camp at first. And there were rumors that West Germany was better than East Germany, but no one really knew.
Mm.
So she bribed her way out of the camp. They ran through a minefield and then were picked up by American soldiers. I mean,
that is so wild.
It's crazy. And then, you know, they were in refugee camps for a long time. She was what they call in Germany a Kriegerfrau. So they were like cleaning up the cities and moving all the rubble while on like really low rations, basically starved herself to keep my father alive. And then my grandfather ended up in a POW camp in Siberia because he fought in the Battle of Stalingrad and survived the battle. Yeah, survived that. So my father actually didn't meet his father until 1949 when he was 9 years old. He came out of the camp with tuberculosis and then somehow it cleared. I kind of love this as an American. My father and his parents came on a boat to America through Ellis Island.
Mm.
Ellis Island closed in 1953, but they came through in 1952. So they were some of the last immigrants that came through, and total classic immigrant story, like post-war, poor as dirt, didn't have anything and had to completely rebuild a life in the United States. Ended up in Chicago. And my final anecdote is that as an old German Frau in the 1960s in Chicago, she was experimenting with this new thing called yoga. And so,
really?
Yeah. So, I know you just asked for one little story.
That's fantastic.
So that's kind of my grandmother. And that was the legacy that I grew up with, even though I didn't know her. She was a hugely influential force in my family. Yeah. And my father... And my father's definitely a mama's boy in that sense. And, you know, always being told as a little kid stories of like a really strong woman, you know, who was thrown into circumstances that nobody would want to be thrown into and figured out how to survive. And that had a huge impact on me growing up. As far as, even though I didn't know her, there was definitely this ideal and also this idea of strong femininity that was just pounded into me ever since I can remember. And I think it really influenced me a lot. Like anytime I was young in New York City, I moved to New York City 3 weeks before September 11th. And so, you know, it's kind of crazy because I grew up in the middle of the country where it's not urban and, you know, there's lots of farm fields and stuff like that. So I moved to the big city. 3 weeks later, September 11th happens. And I was scared. Like there's a lot of emotions with September 11th, right? And I just remember always just kind of tapping into this idea of my grandmother and thinking that you can get through this. Like, you're going to be okay. Like, you have a survivor's blood, right? Like, between your grandmother and your grandfather, they survived and you're going to be fine. And that's always just been a source of strength for me.
Fantastic. That's amazing stories just to get us started in this. So just backtracking a tiny bit. So they were settled close to Chicago. So that's where you grew up in the, so whereabouts, where was that? Illinois or?
Right. So we grew up an hour north of Chicago in the next state called Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So, and then we would just go down to Chicago most weekends because my grandfather and other old relatives were still alive and living in Chicago.
Got it. So as you said, it was quite countryside. And so how'd you grow up? Were you like, you know, a small town or like really rural farm or?
Well, my father had quite an unusual profession / hobby. My father is, he races homing pigeons professionally. And so I grew up on a pigeon farm and we had about 2000, some up where anywhere from 1500 to 2000 pigeons on the property at any time. And even though they're smaller animals, they still take the attention and care that, say, a horse would take. Like, you still have to get up before the sun gets up to take care of them. Like, just because they're smaller doesn't mean that they don't, there's not as much poop to shovel, but like, you know, there's still as much like care and attention that needs to go into it. So we had a house that was in the middle of the woods. We had the lofts there. We were about 15 minutes away from a town of like 80,000. But we were in like the outskirts of town in the countryside.
Mm-hmm. And so this is like breeding the pigeons like horses kind of thing and buying, selling, that kind of stuff?
Exactly. Horses is the perfect example of it. Yeah. You're developing genetic lines. You have studs. You have, you know, it's the whole thing. Yeah. You also have hens that are very important. It's not just the men in horse race, in pigeon racing, but the hens race as well. And you race them. And then, the way that you, you know, make money is people want to buy the offspring of winning birds.
Right.
So they sell those birds. They don't bet on the races. They sell the birds.
And how does it, was your, or is your father like known for a specific kind of quality in the birds or?
My dad was, he was kind of like a boutique specialist pigeon racer. Like he guaranteed every bird that left our loft. He was my father started developing his genetic lines in the 1970s before people were even thinking about it. And it's like running. There's three rough distances. There's sprinters, there's middle distancers, and there's long distance birds. And my dad was really good at middle distance. Wow. And the birthplace of pigeon racing is Europe. And because my father was European and he understood the customs and he spoke the languages, my father was able to travel to Europe in the 60s and 70s and buy birds from the who were considered the masters and then bring those bloodlines into the United States.
Wow. Got it.
Yeah.
I'm saying wow a lot.
I'm like hitting you with all this random stuff. We have nothing
this
to do with
genius. I love it. So you're out in the countryside. What kind of kid were you growing up? Like what kind of, I don't know, games you played or what kind of friends did you have?
Okay. No one ever asks me these questions. So I'm sorry. I'm not like just popping out the answer.
That's absolutely fine.
I was the youngest of four.
Okay.
I am the youngest by far. I was an accident. I have three older siblings who are clustered and then I'm much younger than they are.
Are they boys or girls or both? Or
I have a brother and two sisters. And, you know, I think by the time that parents get to their fourth kid and they're the age that my parents had me at that time, it was old for parents to have kids. They were kind of like, whatever. Like, they were like, this kid's going to be fine. We're not going to kill this kid. Like, it was very much not the first child anxiety at all.
My sister's the same. She's the youngest of four as well.
Yeah. So there's kind of like whatever. So I think I had a very independent childhood because of that. I spent a lot of time alone, but I don't say that as a bad thing. I'm actually quite an introvert. So that was totally fine with me. I loved roller skating. I loved being outside. I was always barefoot. I loved Native Americans. I loved like birds and animals. And, I was also very into music. I read a lot. I was probably a bit of a pain in the ass. I was a stubborn kid. Pretty independent. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite book growing up?
My brother-in-law gave me this is going to sound so pretentious. This is, okay. I don't want to answer that, but I'm not going to answer that. My brother-in-law gave me a collection of Ernest Hemingway when I was 10.
Really?
And here's the thing, like when you're the youngest kid, you're always consuming things that you shouldn't be consuming because everyone else in the house is consuming it. Yes. Right. So like my brother, when I was like, whenever the Blues Brothers came out, I think I was 4 or 5. My brother wanted to make sure that I absolutely knew the Blues Brothers. And I watched that movie over and over again. And, my mother pretty much babysat me with the movie Amadeus. So I've seen the movie Amadeus like more times than, and it's weird, right? Like, but it's awesome. I think this is what happens. Like my brothers and sisters are really into U2 and the Police and Queen. And I'm like a 5-year-old that can sing along to everything just because they stop censoring. And
yes.
I also think this was the day and age like where kids didn't have so much stuff that was specialized for them, right? Yeah. Like you kind of went in the flow of the family.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like that.
Yeah. I can totally relate to that. And it's also making me think, if I'm not wrong, did you hear about a book called We Learn Nothing from Tim Kreider?
No. What is it?
He's a comedian, humorist, I guess, in the States. And he released this book last year. Absolutely amazing. It's one of the best books I've read last year. It's really extremely funny, extremely insightful into the deepest, darkest, messy places of the human mind, but in a very funny and authentic way. And so at some point he talks about his childhood and how he had this kind of opportunity of being totally unsupervised. And nowadays parents seem to like, they're not letting their kids anywhere else. It's totally worth reading. And anybody listening, check out Tim Kreider. We Learn Nothing. Absolutely worth it.
That's amazing. I love that.
Wow. All right. And then I understand you studied later on English and advertising. So where did you get the idea of the advertising part, or actually the English all for that matter, really?
Well, I went to school thinking that I was going to be a business major. Uh-huh. I realized I had to take accounting. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I was really lost. So my first semester of my sophomore year, I just took whatever classes interested me, anywhere from art to set design to advertising. And I stumbled into that. So that's how I got into advertising. The English came from my family's, as most first generation families are, very into education. And my brother is a history professor. So he's very much into like the humanities. And I think I was influenced by the fact that you have these 4 years where you can just go and enrich your mind, kind of like the old school version of college. And, I think I was very influenced by that. And I wanted to study something that probably had no practical application, but that's what you do in college because you want to get your mind to be bigger. So that's why I did the double major.
Brilliant. And then you started working in advertising. Was that your first job at Draft FCB or FCB at the time, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, well, there was a 2-year break because September 11th happened. And
oh, yes. Right. So how did that?
No one hired. It was like the advertising agencies retracted. They went into retreat. So I waited tables for 2 years. And then about 2 years later, I got a phone call, Draft FCB, or it was FCB at the time. And so I started out as a copywriter. And then 2 years later, I flipped into planning.
Yeah. And so why New York? Was there a particular big city, anything in particular? Or
I think my exposure to Chicago as a kid, I always knew that I was going to move to a big city. And I assumed that it would probably be Chicago because that's what most Midwestern kids do.
Yeah.
And then I visited New York and I was like, no, it's going to be New York. So it was a very instinctual decision more than anything. I mean, I moved to New York without a job. I just moved.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was in France when at September 11th, but my elder brother was in New York and he was supposed to open a restaurant that day.
Oh, God.
It didn't open that day. And, but it was, yeah, it was really freaky. And it must have been absolutely even more so there. Crazy, crazy experience. So you started in copywriting as a creative. That's what you were looking for, a writer or?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you flip into working in strategy? How did that work out?
I was a terrible copywriter. Oh God. I hated being a copywriter. I hated it. I hated getting a brief. I hated the whole, like, what are we going to make? I mean, I just.
So for anybody who doesn't know, because there's people who don't work in advertising who listen to this too. So let's give a bit of background and, you know, as to what does the copywriter do in an advertising agency and what did you like and not like about it?
So what a copywriter does is, they get an assignment or a brief either from a planner or an account person saying, we need to make an ad about this product and we need to say this thing. Go say it in a way that's super creative and interesting and fun.
Yeah.
And that's what a copywriter does. And a copywriter partners with an art director, usually, at least in the old school way.
Mm-hmm.
And those two brainstorm together. And the copywriter is ultimately responsible for the writing. And the art director is ultimately responsible for the look and feel and all that stuff of the ad that comes out, whether that ad's a print ad or a commercial or whatever.
Got it.
Yeah. Your brain just sometimes works in one way or the other. And that's just not, I mean, I would get that brief and I would just almost have like a panic attack. I was like, oh God, like I can't do it. And it was this real sense of anxiety. And, when I eventually transitioned into strategy, I've never gotten an assignment from a strategy perspective that I thought I wouldn't be able to ultimately solve.
Mm.
I've had some where I'm like, wow, this is going to be a doozy. But because I feel like my brain is just more in tune to working in that space,
yeah.
I just have more of an inherent confidence in that space. And that helps a lot.
So what would you say, like the strong qualities that you have that make you a good strategist?
I think the storytelling is a big part of that. When I was an English major, I was a creative writing emphasis, and brand planning on its one end is about telling a really amazing story. Like brands at their best are narrative arcs in the same way that religion is a narrative arc or a politician is a narrative arc. And we as society build ourselves around these narratives. And we as individuals build ourselves around these narratives. And so on the one sense, the storytelling aspect, I think, really jives with my brain and being able to tell that story. And then there's this other side of planning that is very methodical and very rigorous where, okay, great. You told this great story. Now we have to be able to put it in action and we have to create the frameworks for that. And I actually have a very strong organizational side to my brain as well, where I like things in order.
Yeah.
So it's great because I get to flex I get to tell these soaring, amazing stories that people can hopefully identify with and then put them into action. And yeah. I like that combination.
Awesome. Brilliant. All right. So we can keep like going through my stalking of your LinkedIn profile. And, I understand you spent a little while in London. You went to work in London for like a short while.
Yeah.
How did that happen? What happened there?
I mean, honestly, I went through a divorce and my life was kind of a mess, personally. And so there was a personal reason and professional reason. Mm. The personal reason was like, I just needed a moment in life to breathe and try something new and just, you know, kind of step away from the life that I knew in New York. The professional reason was that London is the birthplace of strategy, and British planners tend to have a slightly different style than American planners. And I wanted to learn British. I wanted to be exposed to that and be exposed to the heartland of it. And I kind of see my year and a half or 2 years in London is almost like boot camp, like where I really exposed myself to something different. And then, I really didn't like living in London. London made me realize how American I am. Like,
yes.
Growing up first generation, you always kind of feel like, am I really a part of this culture? Am I not? Because you have another culture at home that's really pulling on you and different values, right? And so growing up, I kind of never was like, am I really American or am I more like German American? Like, what am I, right? And then I hit London and I'm like, I am so American. I am optimistic. I have like let's do it mentality. And I really struggled with British culture. I really did. I respect it. And it's ironic because I've dated many British men and my best friend is British. Like my best friend in the whole world is British, But living there, I was like, it drove me nuts. So I had to come home.
Got it. It's funny. I have a bit of the other way around because I was born in the States in Long Island, but grew up in France. And when I was 19, I went to go and, you know, kind of like make it in New York. And I realized I was like, no, I'm not American. I'm European.
Right? Exactly. Different. It's not like one's good or bad. It's just different.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. And so then you started a long career at BBH. Is that right? So BBH is a big advertising agency, very famous for a lot of their work. And you worked for them for quite a while. And particularly there was one like super interesting thing. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of interesting work, but I understand you started a thing called The Barn.
Oh, yeah. No one ever asked me about The Barn.
Oh, really?
The Barn. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us, can you explain to like, what's The Barn?
Yeah. So, I was really well taken care of in my early career. I had very good mentors and I was very blessed to have good internships. And I really am a big believer that planning and just careers in general, but planning especially, it's a craft and we have to pay it forward. When we're taken care of and we're young, we need to pay it forward. Yeah. So I think I was also getting a little hungry to run something at that point as well. And I wasn't at a point where BBH had identified me as somebody that ran things yet. Mm. So I was like, let me run the intern program. And so The Barn was just kind of like an experimentation in management, really. Okay. And an experimentation in, this was right when, you know, everyone was going crazy to figure out how to be more digital. No. And so I kind of saw The Barn as like a mini lab as to how can you manage talent and get creative ideas out in a more digital way. So what we did is we brought in two teams and they were allowed to name themselves, and the teams were given a brief. And so the first year, the team's brief was make something famous.
Okay.
And then they were given a budget of $1,000 and they were given mentors throughout the agency. And then they were just expected to go and do this project over the summer. And, the first year they absolutely succeeded and they got a project that got onto like all the morning news shows here. It was written up all over the world. It actually got more press than most of the campaigns that came out of BBH that year.
Do you remember what it was?
Oh yeah. It was called Dating Brian. So basically there was bless his heart. There was this little nerd boy from Wisconsin, from where I'm from.
Okay.
Which is America. It's kind of like the back, but like, Wisconsin's kind of like, okay, that's cute. And he had moved to New York. He was like skinny and like pasty and he like loved computers. He was like, but he was adorable. And I love Brian. And he had just broken up with his girlfriend, and they decided that they were going to send Brian on 30 dates in 30 days in New York City, crowdsourced from the world of New York. And so
just for context, what year was that in then?
Oh God, that must have been like 2008.
Got it.
No, 2007. Yeah. That's when that was.
Okay.
Yeah.
So still pretty fairly early days for digital social media stuff. You know, there was Twitter started, but it was not, I mean, starting to get big, but not just about, like it was for nerds still. I mean, I got on there. It's 2007.
Exactly. But like the whole premise is like, what if you just give people a problem to solve and you force them into digital tools by giving them a smaller budget and see how they solve the problem.
Yeah.
So that was, it was really interesting in a way of thinking about working with creatives. And then also for me, managing the intern program ended up defining my management style today, because what I looked at other intern programs and thought about the ones that I had been in and the way that it's usually one person in a company that is responsible for it. And that person gets overwhelmed by it. And then the interns end up like not having a positive experience because the person who's managing it doesn't have the bandwidth to do it correctly. And the teams that they're put on aren't prepped to have them. And usually internships end up to be a little like messy, right? Yeah. And like not very gratifying.
Yes.
And so the management premise behind The Barn was empower people with a challenge that they can do on their own, that they don't need to be handheld, but also diffuse the responsibility of the interns throughout the company and make sure that no one person that's working inside a BBH has too much responsibility, but they have enough responsibility where they feel like they need to spend time with these kids.
Yeah.
And I think like, so each team had two mentors instead of just one person, right? And so I think like that diffusion and like empowerment and giving other people responsibility was a really good lesson for me that I definitely took forward as I started my own company.
It's fantastic. I absolutely agree with you with paying it forward and mentorship and everything else. I'm scheduled to go mentor at a school of communication arts tomorrow. So I'm quite excited about that. To go meet a bunch of students. We're going to talk about the briefs they're working on. It's going to be cool.
That's awesome.
And let's see what's next. This is what's next. 6 items or less.
Yep.
Can you tell us about 6 items or less? I just found out about the project and I hadn't heard about it before. So I was just looking at it. I thought it was brilliant, really interesting.
It was really, I'm so glad I did that. I don't know why I did it, but I'm glad. I know why I did it. So I moved to London and I had to pack up my life and I was going through my closet and I realized that I had so much shit. Yeah. And it was like, this is disgusting. Right. And, it was just bad. So I got rid of all these clothes. I moved to London. I put myself on a shopping ban for the first 6 months I was there. I'm like, you're not allowed to buy anything new. You have it in your closet. Just wear it. Right. Mm. So that was good. And I think that was the inkling of it. And then when it, fast forward a year or so after, or 2 years after that, and my girlfriend and I are talking about, my God, wouldn't it just be amazing to have a uniform? Like not have to worry about clothes, just get up in the morning, put it on and get out the door. And we were talking about the way that Steve Jobs did it at the time. Yeah. And even Karl Lagerfeld, even though he's like a high maintenance fashion guy, he has his thing, right?
Yeah.
So she and I, her name is Tamsin Davies. She is an amazing planner in the UK. You should talk to her. And
yeah, definitely. Great. I will.
Yeah. You should talk to her. And she and I decided, we're going to try to do this uniform. We're going to choose. We get 6 items of clothing to wear. Doesn't include undergarments, doesn't include workout gear, doesn't include shoes or accessories, but like that core thing that you put on, you only have 6 items to choose from. So we're like, okay, cool. We set up a little blog for the two of us so we could kind of keep track and track the thing. And then we tweeted it out just to say we were doing it. And some blogs picked up on it. And within a week, 100 people from around the world said, I want to join in. And we're like, all right, fine.
Okay, like, sure. Why not?
Sure, join in. So we let everyone, you know, be contributors to this blog. And we had this community of sixers is what we called them. And for a month, everyone picked their 6 items and they wrote about it on this blog. And it was such a fascinating experiment. I was, I think one of the big learnings I had was that for women especially, there is almost an addictive relationship that we have with our clothes. And we put so much energy towards it. But if you can break that addictive relationship of consumption, you can break almost any habit, it seemed. And just the clarity to wake up in the morning and be like, I'm just going to put this on and I'm not going to worry about it. The way that it changed the beginning of your day, it was just, it's almost embarrassing. Right. It's almost, you're like, I cannot believe that I've allowed this thing to take on so much energy in my life. It was a cool moment to do that.
I think it's awesome. I get it. I pretty much the same. I don't have a huge amount of clothes and I had even less while I was traveling in Asia and living in the tropics where you just have a couple of t-shirts and you don't really have to think about it. It's all you're wearing.
It's great. It's like it's when brilliant. I go on these motorcycle vacations, I literally have an outfit.
Yeah.
And I have two actually, because you get dirty, but like, that's it. And I don't even think about what I put on in the morning. In fact, when I was getting dressed yesterday for work, I was like, oh shit, I have to like think about it again, you know? So, and it definitely influenced my life in the way that now I really try to minimize the stuff in my life. I guess it's ironic working in branding. Stuff has such a powerful pull and it can be such a clutter to your energy and your soul and who you are. And the more you can minimize it and the less attachment you can have to it, I feel like life just gets a lot simpler.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. I agree. And you get to be more selective about what's actually important, what kind of stuff is important. So is this the right time to talk about your travels through America or are we missing anything?
No. You're covering things that most people
don't cover. Okay, we're fine. Very, very good. So that's one thing I was very excited when I first read about it in your blog that you, so can you tell us about it? Like what happened? You decided to go travel, I think in a pickup truck. Is that right?
Yeah. So, for the people that don't work in advertising is an industry of movement. To progress and to get your promotions and to get your pay rises, you pretty much move every 2 to 3 years. That's kind of how it works. I was at BBH for 3 years. I knew it was time for my next move. I didn't know what to do. And it was the first time in my career where I couldn't see the next step.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, that's weird. And so I was sitting at my desk one day, lightning bolt like descends from the heavens, hits my head, and is like, buy a truck and drive around America. And it was like, what? I have this like huge job. I'm like traveling all over the world. I'm working like crazy. Like, this is nuts. But it was such a strong impulse that
it feels like a Fields of Dreams kind of impulse, the way you're talking about
it. It was. You know, one of the only times in my life that that's ever happened. And so I bought a truck and I set out, and I thought that I would go out for 4 months or so, and then I would be begging for my job back at BBH. I'd be crawling back into Emma Cookson's office and saying, please give me my job back. And that's really what I thought was going to happen. But it didn't happen. And it actually completely changed the course of my life. At the time, it was quite unsettling and it was scary. But essentially what happened was, for 2 years, I knew that I couldn't go back to the life that I had, but I didn't know what my life was going to be. Yeah. And for 2 years, I had to just sit in this liminal space between the two certainties and relax and just let the process happen. And for someone like me, that's pretty hard charging. That was a very difficult lesson in the beginning to learn. I eventually got comfortable with that, but it was a really profound 2 years of my life.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were looking for anything, or how did you organize that? Did you just give yourself random destinations, where to stop, start, stay?
Totally random.
Totally random.
The truck was equipped. I slept in the truck most nights. It had a bed in the back. I had a cook set up, like a camping cook set up, so I could make hot food.
Yeah.
And I had clothes, not a lot, just a duffel of clothes. And, I had a annual pass to all the national parks in the United States.
Wow.
And I would pretty much just follow the weather, because when you're living out of a truck, cold and rain is difficult. So I would just try to drive away from the cold and the rain.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And so I'm not a huge Steinbeck expert or anything, but it did really make me think of Travels with Charlie. Did you read that book?
I didn't, because it's been recommended.
You heard about it, but yeah.
Yes. All the travel books like Wild and Charlie and Blue Line, I don't read because I'm living it. But they're on my Kindle. It's like, you got to read this stuff.
But I was wondering if it might have given you the idea beforehand, or if it came from anywhere. Who doesn't know, I read Travels with Charlie a long time ago, but the shorthand of it is that Steinbeck was later in his career, felt that he had been now completely disconnected by who Americans and what America was, and decided to drop everything, build a house in the back of a pickup truck, and go with his dog Charlie to go rediscover Americans in America and get and experience it for himself again.
That's kind of what I did. In fact, that's so crazy to hear that, actually, because the second half of my trip was during the Obama-Romney election. Mm. And I was just horrified by the divisiveness that I was hearing in the media, which was so opposite of the experience that I was having on the road. When I was on the road, I was totally embraced by Americans, and everyone was super kind and generous and just really took care of me. And then I would turn on the radio and I would hear the most vile things going on the radio. And so the second half of the trip, I started interviewing people about the American dream and what they thought about the state of America today. And there's such a disconnect between this horrible media and political narrative that we have versus how people actually live and how they actually treat one another. Yeah. And it's flaring even worse now, as you know. And it really makes me sad, because I think America's a lot better than that. Yeah. I just got off of 2 weeks on the road, and same thing. Like, I'm on a motorcycle. I'm a woman traveling alone. All I have is a tent. So I'm tenting across America. I'm probably the most vulnerable thing you can have, right? And I was so surrounded with kindness and generosity. And I know the people that are being super nice to me were voting for Trump. I know that, you know, cause like it's obvious. They have the bumper stickers, but it didn't stop us from relating to one another as human beings and as and as people that could have a conversation. And I think that we have this very skewed narrative in the country right now that's just disgusting, that is that people make money by tearing us apart. And it drives me crazy. It really does, because America's actually a really good place.
Yeah. Actually, on that note, and this is brilliant. I absolutely agree with you. And do you have ideas or actually knowledge of publications, things to read that are actually talking about something good rather than the usual media spiel that's just talking about doom and gloom? It's a tough one.
You just can't read publications. I think you need to read books.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
hard right now. There's days that I'm a political junkie, you know.
Yeah, okay.
W&W does, we do work with the White House. Like we, you know, and,
okay.
And so I love society. I love reading about society. I love understanding society. But lately there's days I'm like, I cannot log on today. I just can't I get too depressed.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So once you completed your travels, or by more or less like that big period, then you started W&W or?
Yeah, it was kind of an accident.
Yeah.
Myself and Valerie Nguyen, who's employee number one at W&W, were asked to embed in Google's Advanced Technology and Projects Group. It's one of their innovation labs, to be the brand people that helped them when they were in early development of products. Purely for accounting reasons, we needed to set up a corporation so we could get paid. That was all it was.
Sure.
And, but we gave it a name that we thought was cool just in case, like maybe who knows, right? But it was very much a back end thing, right? It became apparent after a few months of our contract that this wasn't the right arrangement for us. Mm. We were commuting to California from New York, which was part of the issue.
okay.
So we had this thing set up, right? And we had the payroll systems and the health insurance, like all that was set up. And we're just like, well, like I had been doing a successful freelance thing in between my traveling. So I was like, look, why don't we do this? Like I'll keep freelancing. I'll get projects and you can just be my junior and we'll just take on projects and then I'll go travel like I used to. And we'll just go on and off. We'll do it that way. And so W&W kind of started as an accident. And then it became very quickly obvious to me that it became an entity that needed to be more than just a pulse on, pulse off freelance thing. I wanted it to be something bigger than that. So it turned into a company, really.
And how do you describe what you do? So you generally do, so you help brands to define their strategy, communications, or how do you say it rather than me trying to?
No, you did imagine. A good job. That was good. We help brands very far upstream. We help them figure out who they are, what their purpose is in the world, and how to engage powerfully after that. We don't get as far downstream as comms. We are working with core brand behavior, core company behavior, and we're helping guide them as that brand articulates into the world, regardless of how it articulates. In fact, I think that advertising is one of the most boring forms of articulation. I think there's much more interesting ways for companies and their brands to articulate, and we help companies figure that out.
Got it. So from a wider perspective, looking at what you're doing, but maybe what the industry is doing generally, what do you think is working in branding and communications these days? So let's say branding, because that's what you're just mentioning is the most important part or interesting part.
Well, I'm totally biased.
Yeah, of course. I'm asking you. So
because after 10 years in advertising, I think that advertising is not is not where the relevance is right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to position myself in a sphere of irrelevance. Not because I'm actually worried about long term. I just don't find it interesting, right? Where what I think is quite interesting right now is, again, like I think as the digital revolution kind of broke open this idea of companies manipulating the populace, right? Where instead companies now are accountable to people, which I think is a much better relationship. This concept of brand and brand being the relationship that we have with our customers has gotten much more infused into just the core of the company, right? It's not the thing that gets slapped on afterwards. It's central to how a company operates. And I think it's like the best time ever to be a brand strategist because we get to be so integrated into what a company fundamentally is if we gain that trust. So I think that, you know, helping to influence that. Now, if I were to pin something on where I think the execution thing is, like where I think the executional heat is right now, I really think it falls into one of three camps. I think a good CMO right now either has a tremendous sense of community and they understand how communities work and how to build them. I think, or they have a tremendous sense of PR and how do you actually get people talking about you in a meaningful way and how do you manipulate the media to be on your side? Yeah. Or they have a tremendous sense of what I would call culture or stunt. I think like Red Bull is a perfect example of this. Instead of running an ad, we throw Felix out of the space thing, right? Like this idea of like culture needs these moments, right? And how do you rub and how do you create friction in culture? And I think that those, like a smart CMO has grown up in one of those. Instead, it used to be a smart CMO grew up in advertising, right? I don't think smart CMOs grew up in advertising anymore. I think smart CMOs grew up in one of those three camps and they figure out how they're going to orient
themselves. Sorry, their just for people, we're chief marketing officer, right? Just.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Chief marketing officer.
Making sure.
Yeah. Apologies. Just to make sure.
Yeah. No, absolutely not. Sorry. Sorry. I interrupted you.
No, please.
Yeah. Got it. That's brilliant. 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 Is there an example of something that you can talk about that kind of illustrates your point or the kind of work that you do at W&W?
This is the hardest difficult thing about what we do.
You can't talk about anything that you do, like the CIA or something.
Well, I can talk about actually one project that we're doing that's going to go public.
Okay.
And it's so rare that we talk about, that we work on something that I can actually, because we're so far upstream, we're so much in core strategy that we can't usually talk about it.
Very conceptual, right? And
private. And like frameworks is usually what we do. But for example, along with my friend, Jason Harris. Jason Harris is one of the, I think he's a founder, CEO, some big title at this agency called Mechanism.
Okay.
We together run this thing called the Creative Alliance. And what the Creative Alliance is it's a collection of creative agencies and creative entities like platforms and things like that, that have come together to help civic engagement in the United States. And we work on initiatives. A lot of the initiatives come out of the White House. And we help amplify these initiatives so that more people are engaging with society and with government. And so something that we are actively working on right now is there is a women's summit. The White House is hosting a summit for women in May. And what our team is helping to do is we help define the brand space that this summit is going to be occupying. And we're helping identify, like, how are we going to get people to understand what the summit is and how are they going to hear about it? So part of the thing that we do at Wolf and Wilhelmina is we also have engagement strategy there. Like once you have a strategy set, once you have that, once you know who you are, how then do you take it out into the world? And so we're helping with the engagement strategy on that. And then, another thing that we do at W&W is that we have an experiences arm because so many clients now, they want to create a tangible experience, whether that's a space or a book or a something so that people understand who they are fundamentally. And so what our experience arm is helping with is we're helping them actually plan out the day of the summit and what the flow of it's going to look like. And the really cool thing about the way that we're doing this, just one more thing, we decided the way that W&W works is we're a very porous organization. If we have to partner with another company, I don't care, right? It's like whatever we need to do to get the work done. And so on this one, we're partnering with BBH. So going back old school in my, right?
Yeah.
And also partnering with a company called RPM, who's really good at influencer and concert marketing because there's going to be a concert involved with it as well. And so we're just kind of helping set like the whole, like, this is what this summit is all about. And there's different ways that we have to articulate the summit into the world. And we're almost like the air traffic controllers where we're helping get that articulated in a really powerful way.
Wow. And so this is going to be published in a couple of weeks. By then, is it something that's online that people can go check out? Is it something people can attend?
Yeah. There's already a website called It's the United State of Women.
Great.
And yeah, people can go there.
I'll add the links to the show notes so that people can check it out. Excellent.
Thanks.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. So I usually finish with a few of what I'm calling the cool down questions. Because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast and it's customary to have an ice cream question in there. somehow. Do you have a favorite ice cream flavor? Do you like ice cream?
Yes, I love ice cream.
Excellent.
Haagen-Dazs vanilla Swiss almond.
Vanilla Swiss almond.
Oh, it's so good.
I've not tried that one. I don't know if I have it in Europe. Actually, I have to check it out.
And
Haagen-Dazs, what do you prefer about it? Is it the flavor thing or a brand look or?
No, Haagen-Dazs does vanilla so well. Like it is like the best vanilla. And then you have this amazing vanilla. And then there's these almonds that are covered in dark chocolate that are scattered throughout it. So every once in a while, it's like playing Mario Brothers where you get the coins. Like every once in a while, you get the coin.
That's awesome.
And you're like, yes.
That is a very, very good segue because that was going to be my next question was about games. Cause, I'm a big gamer, particularly tabletop role playing games, board games, but also video games and classic ones. And I was wondering if you grew up with any kind of games or played still or.
I'm not a gamer.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
sorry.
It's okay. Now, you don't have to be a gamer to be on the show at all. But you still had the Mario reference. So that was something.
Hide and seek. Like I was into sports when I was a kid. Like yeah. I'm very like outdoor physical person like that. Yeah. So that's the closest I was. I'm sorry.
No. Hey, don't be sorry. It's absolutely fine. It's absolutely fine. So I have a question about New York as well, because, you know, I haven't been in a few years and I still absolutely love New York. And obviously like all the New York food classics, what's your favorite kind of New York staple food and which place is your favorite?
Whew, that is quite a question. That's quite a question. Cause like New York goes through all these things. Like we have like our burger phase and we have like our donut phase. Like we go through all this stuff. I mean, obviously you got to have your slice place. Like yes, everyone has
their
local
slice. The main thing I had in mind first.
Yeah. So my local slice is a block away. They know me. It's good. It's all good. You know, so I definitely have my slice. I think everyone also needs their carryout sushi place. Like everyone, like there's so many carryout sushi places and everyone needs their one. So I have it's nothing fancy, but it's the one that like, you know what, that gets delivered.
So is your local slice, your local pizza place a kind of traditional New York or is it the new upgraded version where you just have a couple of pieces of mozzarella and you know I mean?
It's got to cost, a slice cannot cost more than $1.50. Okay.
Still today?
It's getting up around two. Two is kind of where it's at now.
Okay.
You have to take napkins to get the grease off of it.
Excellent.
Like none, you know, I do have my fancy pizza place as well. Like, but that's not roll it up, eat it, shove it in your mouth while you're walking down the street. That's different. Yeah.
I was just making me salivate. I love that stuff. Absolutely love it. And anything exciting coming up in the future for you that you can talk about? Either, I don't know, events you're speaking at or anything else like it?
Well, I'm going to speak at this event in Canada. Contagious Magazine is helping to curate it with the ICA in Canada.
Okay.
I think the ICA is like the Canada Advertising. I'm horrible. I don't know what the acronym stands for.
I looked it up.
It's this event that's like north of Toronto and they're like, oh yeah, it's like in this beautiful area. And I looked at it. I'm like, I'm just going to ride my motorcycle up there.
So
I'm like selfishly I'm super excited to give the talk
because
the point of the conference is about the tension between storytelling and data. Mm. And so I think it's going to be a really interesting conference and I'm super excited that I have an excuse to fuck off and ride my motorcycle for a week and a half.
Yeah.
So there we go. Yeah. Win-win.
Brilliant. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'll add that in the show links as well. And if anybody is looking to follow you, so you still publish posts on WW, like information, blog posts, stuff like that, articles, or do you have a blog personal or?
No, I don't. I'm big on Instagram.
Okay. Instagram.
And I tweet and
what's your Twitter handle?
Uber Blonde. So it's UberBlonde.
Great. I'll add that in. Anywhere else that people can find you? Anything else we're missing?
My Facebook feed is open, so anyone can follow me on Facebook. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant.
Well, Medium. I'm Medium.
Okay. You're right on Medium as well. Great. So that's part of the other places. So I'll of course, add all the different show notes on the links. Last question. What's going on in, even though we talked about branding a lot, but just to have some practical stuff, is there anything that you've seen in terms of ads recently that you really, really liked? Or even the last one that you liked that was quite memorable?
I don't own a TV. So, I watch, I stream everything online. I don't even watch TV anymore.
I don't really watch TV anymore either, but for some reason they get shoved into my face somehow.
I don't.
Oh, really?
I mean, I think, okay.
No, it's okay. It's just fine.
I mean, this is a little cliche, but I think it's actually more important when we think about quote unquote advertising these days. I think the progression that Beyonce has done with releasing her last album, and then she released a clothing line a couple days ago called Ivy Park. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's super interesting that you build up this cult of personality. And if you get that cult of personality built up in a really big way, you can sell people almost anything. Yeah. And I'm not saying she's selling people is bad. Actually, I'm a big fan of Beyonce, but I think we're seeing this across the board. Like, Kardashians are perfect. I am not a fan of the Kardashians, but they are incredibly savvy about this, about building up a personality around essentially nothing that allows them to sell just about anything. And if you're not a brand manager that's paying attention to that, then you are in the dark ages. It's not about the ad that you release anymore. It's about these platforms, and it's about this leveraging of an idea. The Kardashians are an idea, and people want to buy into that idea. So that's actually what I'm finding kind of interesting right now in observing behavior and content and the way that products play into all of that.
So in that idea, and I absolutely agree, actually, just like last one, all the kind of people starting to be celebrity-ish on YouTube that get millions and millions of views, would you categorize that along the same kind of idea?
I think so. I think the only difference is that, like,
because a lot of them have a hard time, like, making money out of it or selling products, and they're still figuring out that space for how to, make money out of the audience that you're starting to acquire, basically.
Well, I think your audience either loves, like, I think you make money, and I've never thought about this before, so I'm just literally riffing with you right now. It's that you're either expert or you're aspirational. Mm. I think it's difficult to make money, like, to go from someone that's funny to selling something, right? Yeah. But like, if, like a Kardashian, if you are, or Beyonce, you're presenting something aspirational, I think that's easy. Or the women who's like, do those awesome makeup tutorials.
Yes.
They're experts, right? Yeah. So then if you say, I want this makeup, or I'm going to create this makeup, then you're going to believe them on that. So I think those are the kind of the two avenues where the monetization works.
Interesting. Fantastic. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for this conversation. It was so much fun. It was brilliant.
Thanks.
And have a fantastic day.
Yep. You too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. That was Heidi. I hope you had a great time listening. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoyed it. Repeated that for the third time. I have to stop repeating myself. I am training and doing my best, but it's, well, essentially as I'm recording every episode that I'm trying to improve little by little what I was doing. As I said at the beginning of that episode, it was one where I tried something different and did a lot less preparation, which I think I had fun in the episode, but I wonder if there was a little bit more ahs, ums, etc., during the episode as well. And I don't know if that was lack of preparation, just my mood that day, go figure. But I'm learning little by little. Somebody who works in radio told me that the practice somehow to acquire is to force yourself to blank rather than go, because that's the automatic reactions to go, or at least it's mine. And I think it's most people's. So I need to remind myself and force myself to pause and blank rather than go as a pause. Anyway, I'm sure you're absolutely fascinated by that. If you have any feedback, questions, comments, I'd love to hear from you. As you know, you can contact me on Twitter. My username is @HippoWell. You can follow me on Twitter. Post a comment on the Ice Cream for Everyone page on Facebook. You can like the Facebook page. Just, type in Ice Cream for Everyone. You'll find it. Leave a review on iTunes or the iPhone podcast app, as I said, or Stitcher, or send me an email if you have any questions. That's Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, @icecreamforeveryone.net. If you're looking for any kind of advice for your brand or your marketing communications, just keep in touch. And that's about it for now. Till next time, bye-bye, have fun.